This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Mandolin player and singer Ricky Skaggs started his career in bluegrass, became a country music star in the 80s, and returned to bluegrass in the 90s. In 1970, when he was 15, he joined Ralph Stanley's Clinch Mountain Boys. He later joined the Country Gentlemen and J.D. Crow in the New South, then formed his own band, Boone Creek. He left that band to back up singer Emmylou Harris. In the early 1980s, Skaggs changed direction and became one of the most successful of the new traditional country artists, recording 10 number one hits between 1982 and 86. He won the Country Music Association's Entertainer of the Year Award in 1985. In 1997, he returned to bluegrass and has been one of the leaders of its revival. His new CD, The High Notes, is a collection of some of his biggest country hits recorded with a bluegrass sound.
All the people would come from far away, they dance all night to the break of day, when the caller would holler, "Do-si-do," the new Uncle Ben was ready to go. Late in the evening, bouncing down high on a hill and above the town, Uncle Ben played a fiddle, Lord, how it rang. You could hear it talk, you'd hear it sing.
That's Uncle Pen, a Bill Monroe tune from Ricky Skaggs' latest album, The High Notes. As a child, Ricky Skaggs sat in with Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs. Terry spoke with Ricky Skaggs in 2003 and began by asking him about his lifelong friendship with Earl Scruggs.
You've known Earl Scruggs for a really long time.
A really long time.
Now, you played with him when you were seven back in 1961. How did you get to play with him?
My father never met a stranger, and we had met the backstage guard. His name was Mr. Bell, at the Grand Ole Opry, which was down at the Ryman Auditorium in those days. And Mr. Bell said, "Okay, I'll let you all backstage, but, you know, you've got to be nice and, you know, don't be bothering people, don't bug them and that kind of thing, you know." And because my dad was always trying to get me noticed, you know, by influential people. And so Earl Scruggs just happened to walk by, and I was standing there playing the mandolin. And he heard me play and got to talking to my dad and said, "Well, bring this little boy down next week for an audition on our television show, the Martha White television show." And we did, and I got the audition, won that, and they set a date for me to come in the studio and record it, you know, when they were, the next time they were going to be recording. And so that, I mean, it was as simple as that. It's pretty amazing to think that it was that simple, but it really, really was. It was just one of those magic moments in time that really did happen.
So what did Earl Scruggs mean to you and his partner Lester Flatt when you were seven?
Well, you know, they were so popular. They were such a big group. I mean, they were so famous, and that was even before the Beverly Hillbillies. And you know, they were Grand Ole Opry stars. And you know, I'd got to play with Bill Monroe when I was 6 years old up in Kentucky. He came to our hometown, and I got to be on stage with him. So I had a little taste of, you know, being around a star, but they were just so inspirational. They had such great music. They had a great band. The songs they sang were really, really good. I really loved the gospel songs that they sang. They really had a great quartet. And just Earl's banjo playing was so good, and it just inspired me to be good on the mandolin. I mean, I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to be good like Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs and you know, Benny Martin, which was a wonderful fiddle player that used to play with Flatt and Scruggs years ago, and Paul Warren and Josh Graves, and those great players that they had in the band at different times. And so they were very inspirational. I guess personally, you know, they didn't take me on the road with them or anything like that, you know, but they were always nice to me and treated me with respect, you know, and encouraged me, you know. You know, this boy can go places, Mr. Skaggs, you know, you ought to keep it, you know, that kind of thing with my dad, you know. So they were wonderful people, and I just, you know, it was great to get to know them through the years. And Lester Flatt passed away, you know, about 10 years ago. And so it's unfortunate that he's not around to enjoy all this great thing that's going on with bluegrass and roots music these days.
So you actually perform with Bill Monroe before performing with Flood and Scruggs. How did you get to play with Bill Monroe's band?
Well, he came to Martha, Kentucky, which is a little small town close to Blaine, Kentucky, where I was raised. And they played the high school, and we, my mom and dad and I, my brothers and sister went to see them. And we watched them unload, and, oh, man, that was the coolest thing to see them get out of this big stretch limousine that they were riding in. And looked like they just walked out of the dry cleaners. There wasn't a wrinkle anywhere, you know. They looked so stinking cool. And they got the bass fiddle off, you know, off the rooftop, and they set up a little sound system. And we went in and sat down and listened to them play. And about 20 or 30 minutes into the show, some of the neighbors in the hood started, you know, requesting, let little Ricky Skaggs get up and sing, you know. And I see it in my own life now, you know, where people start, you know, making those kind of requests, you know, when I'm out on the road playing now. But after, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of that, finally Mr. Monroe said, well, where's he at, you know? And he didn't have any idea who little Ricky Skaggs was. And so I come walking up to the front of the stage, and he reaches down and picks me up and sets me on the stage and says, what do you play, boy? And I said, well, I play the mandolin, sir. And so he took his mandolin off of his shoulder and wrapped it around the, you know, made the strap fit me, you know. And I stood there and sang a Bob and Sonny Osborne song called Ruby, Are You Mad at Your Man? For a 6-year-old to be singing a song like that, you know. But it was the biggest thing that had ever happened, you know, to me in my life at that time, being 6 years old and getting to play with the father of bluegrass music, Bill Monroe.
Did you always sing? Like, you sang from when you were a child?
I did. My mother used to tell me stories. She's since passed on, but she used to tell me stories. She would hold me in her arms, and I could remember this. She would hold me in her arms in church, and I would sing harmony with her, and my dad would play guitar, and I would sing harmony with her. I was very young at the time, and you know, 3-4 years old. And the worst thing about having to sing in church is I had to always give up my chewing gum. My mother would make me spit my chewing gum out, and that was a real bummer. I hated that. Just about the time it got really good, I had to give it up and spit it out. You know, that's just a bad memory.
Is there a certain harmony that's, like, wired into your head from when you were really young, a certain, like, interval that you always sang?
Right. I always heard the third. You know, that's the tenor line is what we call it. If the lead was the one, and the tenor would be the third, and the baritone would be the fifth, usually the fifth would come below, you know, the one, the lead, and until the Stanley Brothers moved it up above the third, which was really cool. But that's the part that I always heard. My mother said she would be working, doing her chores at home, cooking or whatever, and I would be in the other room playing with my toys, and she'd be singing in the kitchen. And she could hear me harmonizing with her in the other room at a young age. It was just, here again, it was just a gift that I could hear that part, you know. Because I guess because she would sing that part with my dad when my dad was home. He worked out of town a lot because he was a welder, and he had to travel a lot to wherever the best jobs were. And so I would hear them sing, and that was the part that made sense to me was the third.
Well, while we're talking about harmony, why don't we play a track from the CD, Three Pickers? And you're harmonizing on this with Doc Watson. And the song is What Would You Give? Are you singing a third higher than Doc Watson on this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love this song.
Yeah, it's a great performance. So here you are with Doc Watson and Earl Scruggs from the CD, Three Pickers.
Brother afar from the Savior today, risking your soul for the things that decay. Oh, if today God should call you away, what would you give in exchange for your soul? What would you give
in exchange?
What would you give
in exchange?
What would you give in exchange for your soul? Oh, would you give in exchange for your soul?
It's Ricky Skaggs singing with Doc Watson, Earl Scruggs on banjo from the new CD, Three Pickers. There are so many bluegrass and country gospel songs that are about death or about losing your soul. What did those songs mean to you as a kid? Were they frightening at all?
Yeah, I've had lots of counseling since then. No, I'm just teasing. The Little Girl and the Dreadful Snake used to scare me to death when I heard that song by Bill Monroe and Jimmy Martin back in the late 50s, early 60s.
I don't know that one. What's the lyric?
The Little Girl and the Dreadful Snake. It was about this little girl that wandered out in the woods and got bit by a snake, and, you know, she dies, you know, and it's just, oh, it just made me so afraid of snakes, you know. Of course, I don't have a lot for snakes even to this day, but there was a lot of songs, like you said, about death and about, you know, death is real. I mean, a lot of people think that you know, death is just, you know, just a dream or something, but it really is real, and I guess with the Irish and Scottish influence in the mountains of Kentucky and western North Carolina, East Tennessee, and the Appalachians there, just our ancestors, we really knew how to grieve. And, you know, I know the Irish, you know, immigrants certainly grieved a lot because I think they really missed their homeland. And it was just part of something that, you know, I know my mother really grieved over my father or her father and of course, my father, too. When he passed away in 96, and she grieved, you know, till the day she passed away. And it was just something that she really couldn't quite deal with and get over, you know. And I don't know if it's a cultural thing that, you know, they think if you get over it that you don't care about them, you know, or is it something that you just actually feel and, you know, and you're going through, and it's part of a healing process. But by and large, most of the music that kids heard was the same music that adults listened to, you know. And so if it had to deal with mother and her passing or the death of a loved one or the afterlife or faith, the salvation, or what happens if you don't have salvation, you know, and those kind of songs. And they were real, and they really did put a I don't know, they put something in, you know, in the back of your mind. They would challenge you to think, you know, and mm-hmm. And maybe grow up.
What was your church like?
Well, we were foot washing Baptist. It's called, you know, it was Free Will Baptist. And
where does the foot washing come in?
the foot washing, they would take that, you know, Jesus did that to the disciples, you know, before, you know, at the Last Supper. Mm-hmm. And that was a, you know, the Baptists would do that. Certain denominations of Baptists would do that. Would kind of follow that that ritual, you know, around Easter time, that kind of thing. And it was is usually after the service, but it was still part of the service. And the men would wash the men's feet, and the women would wash the women's feet. And it's a very, very humbling experience if you've never had a 75 or 80 year old, you know, man get down and, you know, and wash your feet as a young man. It's very, very humbling, especially someone that you've looked up to all your life. You don't feel worthy, you know, of some precious old saint, you know, that you've lived around all your life, that you knew was a very godly man, to humble himself and get down on his knees and wash your feet. I mean, it's a very breaking of the heart, you know, and a very humbling thing. And it lasted many, many years, and now it's almost a thing of the past. You hardly ever hear of that anymore.
Ricky Skaggs speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. His new CD is called The High Notes. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is mandolin player and singer Ricky Skaggs. His new CD is called The High Notes. Skaggs started his career in bluegrass, but in the 80s he changed direction and became one of country music's most popular new traditionalists. The switch to country music also meant a change in image.
You had some classic 80s haircuts also. I think that should not go unremarked.
Those.
Yes.
Yeah, Mac mullet. I had a few of those those mullet hairdos. My kids look back at them now and they said, "Dad, I can't believe that you had that." And I said, "Well, hey, it was the style then."
They made me do it.
They made me do it.
Yeah. You know, I'm just thinking, there's so many things that so many performers in country music do because that's what you're supposed to do in country music, and at some point you wonder why like, why does it go on like that? You know, like some of the costumes and...
I guess in the really in the 50s, late 40s, early 50s through the early 60s, you know, the nudie suits, the big flashy, all
yeah,
that, you
yeah.
know. I think there was a lot of artists that really felt that, you know, when a hard-working mom and dad came to the Grand Ole Opry and paid their money to come and see you, you know, you need to treat them the best you can treat them. You know, you don't need to be dressed just like they are.
Right.
They expect better. They've paid money. They don't want to see you dressed like they are. Because if they do, then you don't look any different, you know, even though you may sing like, you know, the person they come to see, they want to see you dressed to the nines, you know. And so I really think a lot of that was for show. You know, it was before videos. It was before, mm-hmm. you know, the big wide screens. And, you know, if you were setting 40 or 50 rows back, you know, one of those red flashy suits, you could see it all the way, you know, 80 rows back, you know.
Yeah, good point.
And it was just something about, you know, presentation. I think it was a theatrical kind of look, you know.
1996 was a really life-changing year for you. Your father died, Bill Monroe died, and you left country music and returned to bluegrass. Did the death of your father and the death of Bill Monroe connect at all with you returning to bluegrass?
Well, I think it did. Those two men were very, very strong pillars in my life. My dad, you know, had really taught me from, you know, the cradle. You know, he had really worked with me, very patient man, had worked with me and teaching me a lot about music and about how to play it. And Bill Monroe was such an inspiration. He was like a musical father to me. And I knew both of those men really wanted me to be playing bluegrass again. And country music in 96 was really starting to, I don't know, it was starting to really, really change. And I don't know, I just saw the writing on the wall. I mean, I was not new country anymore. The kind of country music that I was wanting to record was really what I had recorded since 81, you know, and... pretty much traditional country music, you know, trying to find really great songs mm-hmm. that said something, songs that had a meaning and love songs, and that just didn't seem to be what was selling on the radio. And so I really felt, you know, too, in my spirit that there was a real paradigm shift about to take place. And I felt like that at Mr. Monroe's death that there was really going to be a change in this music. I just felt like that When he passed away, that there was going to be, you know, just a new audience for the music. And I really think that happened. I think that really, when I look back at it now, I really think that it did happen. I wanted to go back. There was no way that anyone could take Bill Monroe's place. And I didn't, I certainly didn't come back to take his place. But I wanted to come back and take Ricky Skaggs's place because I really felt like that I had a place in bluegrass. And even though I got out of bluegrass, I took bluegrass with me into country music, and now I wanted to return with the knowledge and understanding of business and the understanding of recording and putting on a show. I wanted to take all the things that I had learned and come back, you know, and bring it back to this music. And I really started the record label and all that stuff. And so in 96, it was a bittersweet time. I mean, like you mentioned, my father passed away. Mr. Monroe passed away, but there was even with that death, there was a new birth and a new life that came from that. And I think it was a turning point in my career. A lot of people says, man, you're the smartest guy in the world, you know, but it was just one of those things that I felt in my heart that I really needed to do. And it was the right thing.
Well, Ricky Skaggs, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's great being with you today, Terry. Thank you.
Ricky Skaggs speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. His new CD is called The High Notes. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.